It doesn't have any rhyme or the narrative, but you can feel the cold in this film. Yeah. Like, that is a Mexican who's experienced depression.
Yeah, no, literally going on what you're saying, my girlfriend, we just went to Europe there.
Yeah.
And we traveled around a bit. We went to like Spain, stuff like that, places where the weather was quite nice. But then as soon as we got to Ireland, she was like, why would anybody live here? You know, not in the modern age. Like, why would anybody like set up a civilization here? And I'm like, chill. It's not that cold. I think it was like 16 degrees. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. You know,
no, but to be fair to Delia, my girlfriend, when we stepped out, it was -4.
Oh Lord! Again, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit.
Yeah, we don't know what that is either. but having lived in London and been there in the winter, like it's cold, but it's I can understand like people who live in Miami, they come to New York and they're like, oh my God, it's freezing. You know, how can you live here? So I get it.
But yeah. Also, I think like because Britain is like, it's a miserable cold, right? Like, it's not just like, oh, it's cold. It's like, it's cold and it's wet. And like, I can feel it in my fucking bones.
Yeah. Is that why they have pubs in every corner? Is that why?
Exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
I remember back in the day when I used to work in London pubs, like working in London pubs around Christmas, you would literally get like a glazing of moisture on the inside of the window because everyone came inside wet and then it would like evaporate inside the pub.
Oh, the worst was the buses. Sitting on a bus first thing in the morning,
yeah.
The condensation on the windows. No.
Sit back in your seats, get something to eat, and watch this movie. Don't let the kids see it because, well, we'll let you hear the thank you.
All right, and welcome to Left of the Projector, where we discuss films from a leftist perspective. If it's your first time listening, you can go ahead and subscribe. That'd be great. You could also drop some 5-star reviews if you like it. This week, we're talking about Children of Men, which came out in 2006. It almost feels a little bit too relevant in 2023, but here to discuss it, I have the hosts of the podcast, Bring Out Your Dead, Latin America versus the British Empire, Chris and Gruff, who've just concluded their first season of their podcast, which they should also tell you all about as well. Thank you both for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for the intro.
We definitely will tell you all about it.
Yeah, should we tell you now?
Is this the time?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah,
give a little breakdown of your season.
Go ahead. Yeah, this is Griff's brainchild. So, Griff, you tell me.
So, this is, Bring Out Your Dead Pod. It is a narrative history of all of the things the British Empire has done in Latin America, basically trying to cover that history because no one else really has. So, we're basically constructing a narrative. Right now, we've only got to 1600. So, we got plenty of material to work with.
There's a lot of stuff that they've done to cover, I'd say.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. With the British, there's always more.
Yeah, there is.
Under every rock around the world, you find a tiny Union Jack.
Somewhere. Yeah.
Who put this here?
Yeah. Well, I think you had suggested, or I think I sent you a list of some films, and Children of Men came, popped out to you. I don't know if you have any just kind of general thoughts on the movie, you know, maybe why you chose it, what kind of the movie might mean to you or today.
Well, yeah, like Griff told me that there was a list, but he didn't show me the list because he made up his mind like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, as soon as I was reading to that list, you know, there's plenty of good films on there, but Children of Men immediately jumped out at me. And the reason for that is, you know, I'm Welsh, but, you know, British. And I mean, in Britain, this movie has essentially become a meme almost, in the sense of every year it seems to get more like the Britain that actually exists. It seems that Britain is constantly going that direction. I mean, you know, we can talk about the fact that the British government is still trying to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, or, you know, the fact that, yeah, it's just becoming a more authoritarian state. And it seemed not impossible, but didn't seem possible in 2006. It seems very possible in 2023. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and I've seen the movie many, many times. And I've seen it many, many times. And I remember seeing it first when I guess it came out. And I immediately found out that there was a book. It was based on a book. So I think I got my mother to get me the book. And she was nice enough to get it for me. And yeah, I've been in love with that movie ever since. It's a movie you watch every couple of years.
Yeah.
And every time you watch it, like if you don't watch it long enough, it slips down your, you know, favorite movies list. And you almost forget about it, and you see it, and you're like, wait a minute, wait a minute, Children of Men is outstanding.
Yeah.
Outstanding movie. So yeah, it was a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Really?
It does feel like an underrated movie that I think is often forgotten. I think maybe, like you said, maybe it's more of a movie that's on top of mind or popular within, you know, the UK versus America. I think I maybe told one of you this, that I actually saw this movie in the theater when I was living in London. So I remember watching it in a theater with, you know, a bunch of Brits and a few other people, and thinking, there's no way this could happen. You know, this is 2006, yeah, right? Like, oh, we're fine. But that's actually the first thing that I kind of noted when I was watching it again, is usually when you watch a dystopian movie that takes place 20, 30 years in the future, you think of automation, you think of flying cars and, you know, things like that. You don't usually think of a movie that is dystopian where it's kind of like this haunting version of modern day society. Or if it is a haunting version, it's more of like a authoritarian dictator in the future with flying cars. But this is just a decayed Britain.
Yeah, I think it's like the thing I was saying to Chris, because I know Kwadon, he had done the Harry Potter movie before he did this, obviously spent time in Britain. But it is like a stunning depiction of the sort of the darkness at the heart of British culture. I think there's a very intentional choice to, like, obviously set it in the future, but not make it feel like the future. It seems to be like, this is what Kwadon just sees at the heart of Britain, at the heart of that culture. And like, to me, it like, as a British person, it is such a like fantastic sort of depiction of that.
Yeah, and I think it kind of fell in his lap a bit. I think the book was actually based in 2021 or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yep.
Just a few years before it was that, right? And yeah, that was based in 2021. And it's sort of, it is in the future, but it's just the near future. So I don't know. We were talking about this, you know, there's no like Nokia, there's no like flip phone, Motorola,
yep,
Matrix moment.
Yeah.
You know? And because it's just out of reach in the future.
Yeah.
So everything looks familiar. There's a couple of elements of futurism in there, but very sparse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better for it.
And
aging like fine wine.
And everything futuristic, because again, like it seems so much like Britain, because this is what Britain is like now after austerity, but like everything futuristic is only partially futuristic. Like with the buses, like the buses have these animated posters on them, but they are just shitty buses from 2000. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's like,
and we have these now, all right? That's like, you literally see animated, yeah, buses and you're, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually something I was going to bring up, because this is the movie starts, right? Very beginning, and it starts with propaganda, right? It starts with this image. I think it's, you know,
it's the news, right?
It's the news.
Yeah.
Oh no, it's news because baby Diego's dead.
It's TV, right? And radio kind of both kind of intermixing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we just see, we're looking at a crowd of cafe customers as they're looking, but, you know, just off camera to us.
Yeah.
And right at the front, this will come up later, I'm sure we'll bring this up, but there's a woman and she's holding a dog.
Yeah.
And of course, this will come up later. The whole element of like animals, mm-hmm, becoming like, you know, proxies,
yep,
for kids, which they obviously can't have. But if we follow Theo outside the cafe and we see that shitty old bus, right?
Yep.
And we see that modern, futuristic advertisement on the side.
Yep.
Do you know what's on that advertisement?
Is it the quietest, like the suicide kit, or is it?
It's not. It's an ad for dog clothing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yes. I noted that as well. Clothing. Because dogs do seem to take up the mantle, like you said, of children, uh-huh, like the way that you can connect to something that's, you know, that you can take care of. You've lost,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And we do see that as the movie progresses.
Yeah.
I think most characters have or are kind to animals, uh-huh, except for Theo.
Yeah,
especially the beginning. He just has he doesn't care.
But they, yeah, like
just,
him.
He's just
they
crippled like by ennui. Mm-hmm. Ah, yes, but they like him. You,
yeah,
are right.
And again, that is, yeah, sort of part of... Sorry, Evan, you go.
No, yeah, that's all I was saying, is that they like him, which kind of adds an interesting layer where... I don't know what to make of that exactly.
There are a lot of animals in terms of pets, but there are also a lot of animals in terms of farm animals, right? In the scene where he meets Jasper, you see like cow corpses burning in the field. When he finds out, I forgot the character's name, but...
Which character?
The one who's pregnant. God, I forgot
Key.
The name. Key. When he finds out Key...
She is the key, Griff.
Yeah. But when he finds out Key is pregnant, he's in a barn, and it starts with Key telling him about how they mutilate the cows.
Mm-hmm.
And, yep, so there seems to be this very sort of clear distinction, right? And Theo's sort of place in this story is he's essentially the only person who isn't exploitative or isn't looking to exploit something. He's the only one who, like he says, like, you're the only one I was told to trust, because he's the only one who doesn't have this element of wanting to exploit things inside of him.
You see his job very briefly, where he works for a government agency. I forget which one it was, the Ministry of Energy. And it doesn't really matter. It doesn't seem like work is much of a any kind of, it's not even part of this movie, the idea of like working.
It is interesting to me though, because I know you say like working, it's only in there very briefly, but the idea that like humanity has about 20, 30 years left, but you still have to go to your shitty job.
Yes. What are they doing?
Yeah, right.
But again, I think that's the thing. Everybody in this movie is looking for purpose. That's what they're looking for. This like ultimate purpose, as you could say, like of reproducing, is off the table.
Yeah.
So people are looking for purpose. Some people are doing it more actively. Some people are doing it through political means.
Yeah, they have the religious movements.
And some people are just sticking their head in the sand. And Theo is one of these characters. And I think we're surrounded by those sort of characters in his work.
Yeah.
He asks his boss, you know, like, oh, can I... can I get the day off? And the boss's room is just full of cricket memorabilia.
I know. I don't know what to do with that. But I don't know what to do about that.
Because it's just bland. I think it's just because it's bland. He's surrounding himself with the ordinary.
Yeah.
Right? Because it distracts him from what's going on outside. Yeah. And another thing that I noticed is Theo was just in a terrorist attack, right?
Yeah.
He was just in a cafe that blew up.
Yeah.
Right? He goes to work.
Yeah.
Right? And he goes into his boss and he says,
Baby Diego.
And he goes, oh, can I get the day off because I'm affected by Baby Diego? Not that I was just in a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
So, like, this shows, like, and everybody, of course, is crying at their monitors.
Mm-hmm.
This Baby Diego thing, nobody's worried about the fact that just down the street just blew up.
Yeah.
You know, the world is falling apart. They're used to that. Mm-hmm. But what they hold dear is this, like, Baby Diego, this idea of possibility.
Like the youth still exists.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, well, it does say that the mantle has been passed to a woman.
Yeah.
But they don't even say her name.
Yeah, it's not really part of the story.
Yeah. Or maybe they just didn't say it. Maybe that's saying something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting the kind of the world they've constructed, sort of this this version of their dystopia, which we kind of briefly alluded to, but you said, obviously the whole point of the main focus is that people can't have children anymore and they're idolizing children as like celebrities. They become like the new celebrity, but they don't give very much detail into what happened to Earth. You know, what happened? They have some newspaper ads and some things that we see later when he meets Julianne Moore's character.
Jasper.
It's
Julianne.
Yeah. Julianne. So, you see like the newspaper clippings that they have in the little room later, but it just seems like that a nuclear fallout from around the world and some kind of, I guess it doesn't matter that much, but people are now left impotent and they can't figure it out. They
One of the things that was interesting to me is Jasper, when he visits him the first time, his like one friend, he tells him a joke about the human project, and he says like all these scientists are gathered to try and figure out. And some of the scientists say maybe it's pollution that made us infertile. Some say it's genetic experiments. So from that joke, we know in this world, one of the main theories is that pollution made everyone infertile. But they just haven't stopped polluting. Like, you know what I mean? And it does seem to me like, I know Cuarón, he speaks quite explicitly about what he's trying to do with this movie. But it does seem to me so much like this pastiche of neoliberalism, because I mean, if you think of neoliberalism as like its own force, it is essentially an abandonment of the future, you know, like cut infrastructure, cut investment, take all the money out, fuck the next generation. And it seems to be like so much of this is like alluding to that, like, okay, so we just killed humanity by polluting too much, but we're not going to stop because we need to make money. You know, humanity's going to end, but
because
you gotta
because they're not sure. But they're just and it's the exact same as like climate denial.
Know
for sure.
Yeah.
So let's not do fucking anything.
Yeah.
Let's not change our behavior at all.
Or do the bare minimum and say you did something.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually something else that we were saying, that like when going back to that very first scene, and once you exit the cafe and you see London, mm-hmm. 2027.
Yeah.
And it's just filthy.
Yeah.
Right? Pollution everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, I don't know, Evan, I think you might have said this to Griff as well, is that like he wanted to make London look like Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what he wanted to do. Yep.
I think he explicitly said that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've been to Mexico City.
Yeah.
And we can say, yeah.
Yes.
In some parts.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, Mexico City, it's a lovely city. It's a great city, but there is an element of chaos to Mexico City. It's, you know, it's a massive population, massive highways, lots of traffic, lots of smog, pollution. And there is an element of it being like you have to live here because it's one of the biggest cities in the Americas. You have to come here if you want to make it as a Mexican artist or things like that. But it's also like a bad environment to be forced into, and there seems to be this element of that. Like every time they leave the city, it's kind of lovely in a lot of places. There's like forests are coming back, there are like deers around and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But they've all just like hunkered down in this heavily polluted, overcrowded city.
Yes, well, like when they go to that farm where they're hiding out later, there's clearly land and space for everyone to just live comfortably and not go to their shitty desk job that's pointless at this point.
Like Jasper. I mean, literally like Jasper.
Yeah.
And there's clearly enough land as well. Like, yeah. Because of course we'll obviously get onto the immigration aspect of this movie, you know, which has become more prescient now.
Yeah.
More than ever.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. I think it's maybe worth, cause I know, you know, you already mentioned, you know, the opening, the bomb, and he gets the day off and he takes this train to go out to see his friend Jasper. But I think on the way there is where you get the first glimpse of what this modern version of London and England is like, with the caged people who are immigrants, migrants. They're trying to get in, trying to just live. And it's basically a point where no one who is from anywhere else can come into the United Kingdom. You have to carry your badge and your whatever, the pass everywhere. And we discover later they're just putting them into camps. You know, they're just letting them kind of be on their own and live in their own little fenced in cities.
I think like it's because it, on that train ride, that's also where you get the propaganda video that's playing on a loop, right? Mm-hmm. Where it kind of tells you like the world has collapsed and Britain alone soldiers on, which again, as a phrase, like he nailed that. That is the exact phrase a fucking conservative British person would use.
When did Keep Calm and Carry On? That was under the
Blitz.
Of course, but like when it had its resurgence.
I think it was like the Cool Britannia thing in the 90s.
Oh, was it? Yeah. Oh, okay, all right.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's like, one of the things that's so amazing about it is for a movie that like has built this whole new world, which like you were saying, Evan, at the time it seemed like completely different from anything that was happening. There's essentially no exposition. Like you get the news story, which tells you that like, okay, there's no children anymore. You get the train propaganda advert that tells you this is now a fascist Britain. And then you get the train station, which shows you they're rounding up immigrants. And so it's like, it's so well constructed, just that sort of first day of the movie almost, where you go through his day and you suddenly understand everything that's happening.
Yeah, well, that's what Cuarón said, like, and he's done this before in his movies. It's the background storytelling element of it, you know, and how the background is so important. He's doing that. He's letting the background say so much. He also lets the camera wander around in the background sometimes as well. Like that really puts you as a viewer like right in the center of it. You're not just following the character, even though we majority are. There's moments where it wanders away, mm-hmm. like it wanders up to the cages. And I think I saw it. I'm going to actually look at my notes here because I couldn't remember the guy's name. But the screenwriter, I think it was Emmanuel Libet. Emmanuel.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said, like, not a single scene of this movie can go to waste.
Yeah.
You know, so it's so rich. Mm-hmm. Like I actually watched this movie about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I was planning on making some notes. But I just was lost in the world so much that I just had my notebook beside me with nothing written on except Children of Men at the top. You know? I was all ready to take notes. But
well, at least you can say you know what movie you watched, so you're good to go.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And to your point about the camera wandering and kind of giving you a glimpse, one of the parts on the train that I also found fascinating is they briefly show kind of as he's on the train, kind of his view outside, and you see kind of graffiti on the wall, kind of disparaging immigrants, and you have people throwing stuff at the train. You kind of get a very brief glimpse of what it looks like in London, because you don't really, because you only have the scene in the coffee shop in the very wealthy, his friend he goes to visit later on, who's living in with the Tate Modern, I guess, as that was.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you don't really have much perspective in like the London era. You kind of get the scenes and the farm and everything. So I do like that train ride. And then you get to the point where he's at Jasper's and he's hiding out in this beautiful solar powered little kind of mini compound, which
with shit tons of weed.
Yeah. Did you notice this actually, Evan? I noticed it only on the last watch through. We watched it through there, the two of us together 2 days ago. And yeah, and I just watched it, as I said. So it's like, this is fresh in my mind. So I was looking at the minutiae. I was looking at the tiny details. And I do not know if this is in my mind, but some of the graffiti on the wall, on another train carriage, I think, just as the scene ends and we see Theo like on the left of the camera, and on the right of the camera it says last to die.
Oh yes, I do, that sounds right. I didn't note down what the graffiti said.
Chris has a whole thing on this, that every character's death is introduced in their opening scene.
I can go through it now, or I'll go through it incrementally, right? But that's Theo's one. Obviously, it's a longer phrase. It's something about, you know, the last, you know,
because turn out the lights, right? The last one's died, turn out the lights.
Yeah. Something like that, right? But yeah, like I noticed that. And yeah, and then I noticed some other elements regarding characters' deaths coming up. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that when we get to it.
Yeah.
And you can tell me if I'm just looking too much into it or not.
But so we kind of have the scene at Jasper's. You told the joke that Jasper's telling him. And I think the character, you know, that they created for Michael Caine here is pretty interesting. He clearly is like kind of a hippie, you know, pot smoking kind of guy. And did they say he was a journalist? Or no, it's cartoonist. It's cartoonist.
Yeah, in the background, they show it in a shot in the background.
Yeah.
Cartoonist.
He was a political cartoonist.
But he, you know, he did well, and he's kind of living on his own. And it's really only through him that you actually get glimpses of, you know, what Theo had like gone through, you know, in his life. You kind of have like pictures and you kind of have him mentioning things. And I like how they bring in things that it's not too obvious, kind of bringing in the details, which I think is also to how they build the whole world here.
Oh, yeah, it's masterfully done, because how they introduced the Tomorrow Project?
The Human Project.
Human Project.
It's
with a joke. Yeah. He goes, all right, the Human Project are sitting there or whatever,
yeah,
you know, and then Theo goes on some diatribe,
yeah,
and he goes, hey, I was just trying to tell a joke.
Yeah.
You know, like it very organic. It is exposition. It's just pure exposition, but it's just done so well.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, masterfully acted
by,
first of all, the Clive Owen, who knew he could actually be like such a quality actor. And he's not bad, but he's just, you know, middle of the road. But Michael Caine.
Yeah. I think as we were watching it, Chris just spontaneously shouted, why is he such a classic character?
He is.
But you're right, though. Clive Owen is very good in this movie. And I feel like there are a lot of movies where he's, you know, okay, a lot of action movies.
This was like the height of his fame, right? Because he never got to like sort of A-list, but he was kind of B-list at this point. And again, like you say, he was sort of trying to become like an action guy, and then this one where it's in his face. Like his face is perfect. It's just like that. It's like a little bit droopy. It's kind of miserable, and it just like
he just looks
like English for the character. Like,
he's an Englishman. It's everybody's face, no?
I do like the way that they have set up, you know, Jasper. And then the one little note that I put down, and I don't know, it's kind of, I hate using this phrase in like episodes. I sometimes say it kind of like a MacGuffin, where they allude to how Jasper is selling weed to the fascist police officers, which they use later for their own advantage. But at the time, obviously, you're just thinking like this guy's, you know, selling to the people who are creating the police state, and it's
I do kind of have a thing on that. I don't know if it makes sense to bring it up when we get further through the story, but in terms of, so like Jasper is one of only two sets of characters that provide unconditional help to Theo and Keith, so that he unconditionally helps them when the fishes have turned on them. And the only
spoiler,
and the only other group that helps them is this Russian family inside the immigration camp. And in both cases, they give Theo a pair of shoes. But in Jasper's house, he gets a pair of flip-flops in Britain in November. You know, it's like better than nothing, but it's help that's not really going to work, right? And like you said, Jasper
he obviously was political, but he's essentially sold out. He's given up, and now he's like, his business partner is a fascist cop.
Yeah, so he flip-flopped.
Yeah, he flip-flopped. But also, yeah, like, the help he provides them by like hooking them up with this police officer ends up putting them in extreme danger when the police officer comes back. Mm-hmm. Whereas this Russian family, who are the only characters to be identified as leftist, they have like a big Lenin sort of monument in their house.
That one, yeah.
They provide unconditional help and they get them out of the city. And they it is not help that puts them in danger. It's not help that causes them problems. The shoes they give him are trainers. They give him like sports shoes. And it seems to be like this clear kind of parallel between sort of people who have maintained like their ideology, who do not accept the conditions of this world, can still like provide actual help. Whereas Jasper, who has sold out, wants to help, but ultimately can't. He's just not able to because he has accepted the conditions that this world exists in.
I think it's important, I think, that you mentioned that the Russian family later being sort of having a left leaning. I feel like the note that I actually wrote down when I said that Jasper's selling weed to fascists, I wrote down that he kind of, to me, is just kind of like the classic liberal, where he, you know, kind of wants to do good, means to do well, but really is just kind of going along and kind of willing to sell out. Whereas this family is living in this, you know, this migrant camp. They don't have to help anyone. I mean, they don't, there's, their life isn't probably going to get any better, but they realize that someone's could, and that person down the line could have an impact on everyone. So
I think it is a very interesting point. It's one, it took me, I had to sit with it for an hour, because what brought me to it is, it's like, why is there so much focus put on Theo's feet? Like, what is the deal with his feet?
I remember you were saying it while we were watching it. You're like, there's something here. I'm going to pass this out.
Yeah. And that, like, to me, that's kind of what I came up
with. And then, so I think maybe we also can talk about the fishes. I mean, I think you alluded to the fact that later on they're maybe not the most helpful and they kind of betray the cause, but you have this kind of underground group that's basically looking to, even before they know there's a, you know, they have this pregnant woman, they're kind of rebelling against, you know, the fascist government. But the thing they also clearly mention is that they stopped committing, you know, I'm using quotes, terrorist attacks. And it seems that's now where it's the government who's actually doing this to maintain control over their population. And I think it's always interesting in these kind of movies. It seems like a very dystopian film kind of trope that I think has done really well, is how you want to trust this group that portrays themselves as, we're going to help, but at the end of the day, they're not in it to help. They're in it to...
Yeah, yeah. Well, they only portray themselves as an alternative.
Yes, that's really true.
You know, like, it's not like, like, what's their ideology?
Yeah, they're pretty apolitical as a group. You don't know anything about what they... Like, they don't want immigrants to be oppressed, but
they say equal rights is the only thing I feel like they mention.
Yeah.
Which is very vague. You know, like, we want equal
very
rights.
Very vague, very vague. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very, very broad. Yes. No, when he gets picked up by the fishes, and then he ends up in that like holding cell with newspapers all around it, that's when we meet Julian. I think Guardon had at least me in such a state of alertness where I was looking in the background the whole time.
Same.
I remember when I watched this like 2 or 3 weeks ago, it's just like, I wasn't even paying attention to what they were saying. I was just trying to read the newspapers, you know? And I'm like, there's something here. There is something here.
There was a lot of interesting, and they apparently completely constructed from scratch all of those newspaper clippings to have that very real feeling.
Yeah, yeah, it did come across really well, but I was like, is there going to be something deeper in there? And I couldn't.
Well, Evan, a while back you sent me like a shot of one of them, right? Which was, it's like Russia drops a nuclear bomb in Kazakhstan or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of doesn't mention Britain very much in these stories, where it's trying again, like that propaganda reel you're talking about on the train, where Britain is trying to like wipe their hands and say, oh, we're the good guys. We're just kind of plugging along. It's all the other countries that have turned us all to shit. It's their fault.
Yeah. But
sounds like a
just like
newspaper.
Today.
Yeah.
Front cover of the sun.
So it's not a dystopia, I guess, is what you're saying. It's just...
it is interesting. Like, I mean, for me, from a British perspective, it's like I was saying to Chris, it's like, there's no way Quran could have predicted like the 2008 financial crash. But like that is what caused the austerity that happened in Britain. And that is why Britain now looks like this film. And it's just like, I don't know how he, like, I know he talked about he was reading a lot of political philosophy and things like that while he was making the film, but I don't know how he just nailed, like, the condition Britain would go into so well. I don't know how he did it. Like,
I'll tell you now, Evan, are you ready for your next death?
Oh, yes, I am.
You ready? Okay, I'll tell you.
Oh, does it happen inside of the box they're in?
It's the first scene where we meet somebody, then foreshadows their death. So it's the same as Theo when he's on the train. It says last to die, and then he'll be last to die. And then when Julian says at the end of their meeting, because, yeah, to summarize the movie, basically Theo says, fuck off, like, I'm not doing this. And then she said, all right, well, if you change your mind, you know, or she says something cool.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
They're going to give her some money too.
Yeah, to sweeten the deal. And then they, you know, they put a bag on his head and they haul him off. And then the camera trucks back. And then you see Julian there. And she says that famous line. It's a line I always remember. Yeah. It's like, you hear that ringing in your ear? Do you hear that? What does she say?
It's your eardrums dying.
You'll never hear that sound again. That's their swan song.
Yeah.
All right. So in our soon after that, right? Yeah. We are obviously in another famous scene, one of the other long shots.
Yeah.
Right, where they're in the car and the car gets attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, Julian gets shot, and she gets shot. And when she gets shot, that ringing sound comes out. And goes, right? So that's one part of it. Yeah. Second part of it, for some reason, Julian has a tattoo on her neck of a bird, right? And that's exactly where she gets shot. And at that opening scene, when we see her in that room full of newspapers, all we can hear around her are the sounds of flapping wings of birds. Mm-hmm. So I know I'm grabbing at a lot here, you know, or even we could say she says it's their swan song, like a bird, and she gets shot right in the bird, right in her neck. That's the hope.
The bird stops singing.
The wings. Yeah, the bird stops singing, and all you're left with is that So I think she also foreshadowed.
I did not notice that. So that's. But on this show, there have been things that have been like, you could say, like, are a very big stretch. I don't necessarily would say this is like a stretch.
It's within its world. It's within the characters. Uh-huh. You know, it's within the palette, I would say. I wouldn't say it's like super meaningful or hidden or anything, but it's just in the palette.
The next one is definitely much stronger in terms of play. We'll get to that when we get to it.
I already told him.
We don't want to spring everyone's death all at once. It might bump people out more than the movie already did.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so we kind of get this point now where, this is the other question that maybe it's obvious to me, is the reason why Theo needed money was because he had gambling debts. Is that the implication when he's at the track and he's gambling on?
And he's an alcoholic as well, right?
Right. So he's presumably not getting paid very well at the Department of Energy. And so he needs the money. And you see him slowly kind of having this, maybe I'm going to help. And the thing he kind of makes his decision is he goes to see his friend who's living in the Tate Modern, where the only time in the movie you see someone of just extreme wealth. Mostly everyone in this movie is, I mean, I guess you could say that Jasper has some money, but he's not a man of great wealth.
Yeah, and it's...
What's the character?
It's his cousin, right? I can't remember his name.
Nigel?
Sounds right.
Yes.
Yes, he works at the Ministry of Arts
it's
program.
The Arc of the Arts.
Yeah, and also before he gets there as well, he's in a Rolls Royce, and then he goes to like Hyde Park, and you see the Kingsguard now, but the Kingsguard are riding past, and there's like this sort of 19th century sort of like Victorian fair happening in the park. And you can see, right, it's like, so there is wealth, right? There is wealth in this society. And it's just that like the entire bottom has been cut off. You know what I mean? There's like, there's this wealth being hoarded, and Theo is sort of tangentially connected to it through his cousin. But like you said, it's the only part of the movie where you don't see like sort of pollution, you don't see overcrowding, you don't see all of these cars going all over the place. And it's like this idea that, again, right, I think going back to this idea that it's just neoliberalism, right? This class on the top have just become the new aristocrats.
living amongst, he's talking about how the paintings they've saved from, you know, the people who've destroyed them. Like, we're saving the arts for nobody because no one will be alive in 30 years to even see these pictures.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's called the Ark of the Arts. That's the department. And there's so much to parse out. Yeah. There's so much to take out of this.
There's even that first line where he's talking about, is it rescuing David?
Lapieta.
He rescues Lapieta and he's like...
He couldn't.
He's like, yeah, that thing in Milan, it was terrible. Yeah, he's like, that thing in Milan was terrible. And Theo's like, yeah, it was pretty bad for the people too.
Well, I think, they mentioned he had saved David and one of Pablo Picasso's painting, a Banksy.
Yeah, and that, the Banksy's actually in the car park. When he arrives in, the Banksy's in the background, it's just in the car park, you know? And then,
the fanciest car park you'll ever be in.
And the thing is, he says, we couldn't save Lapieta, right? But Lapieta is the mother holding her son.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, there's no new mothers. Uh-huh. We could save the art. We could save these other depictions. We could save war because we see Guernica. We could save man, but man has like a fucked up leg.
Yeah.
Right? But we couldn't save motherhood. We couldn't save like fertility.
And you see that immediately paralleled in the fact that while they're eating lunch, his son is there. And there is literally like no paternal instinct, no love. You know, this is a young kid who like supposedly should be like this great thing. This is like a 19, 20 year old in this world. And this is the son and the nephew of Theo. And they have like no affection for him. They have no connection to him at all. It's like he's just like another object of value.
I think that I like to think of it as just people don't know how to treat children anymore, because I think earlier I mentioned kind of how they now are celebrities in this culture. You know, the entire world is mourning the loss of a celebrity, like they, you know, a kid, like they might mourn the loss of like Princess Diana or something, you know, so.
And they actually do show them putting flowers down in a part of London, just like with Princess Diana, right?
I don't know.
They did, yes.
Yeah.
They no longer look up maybe to the crown, because there is no indication of the monarchy, really,
it's,
is there?
Again, it's very apolitical, right? There's no fascist party. There's no government. Like, the government is just the, like, jackbooted police on the ground, right? And so it's really interesting in that sense that, like, same thing with the fishes. There's, like, it's a very kind of apolitical existence, right? That almost, like, everyone has abandoned the future. Like, why have a fascist party if there's no future? Why have, like, you know, this sort of this grand movement if there is no future?
They've abandoned all, like, pretenses of any kind of governing or any kind of actual... I mean, you'd think that all the money they'd have at this point would be putting into science to solving their crisis.
I've already said it, Evan, but much like today.
Really? Oh, I just say neoliberalism would never do that.
No, never. We were watching it, and as I said, like, that was my interpretation of the different art on display, you know, like, you know, what it represents. And obviously Guernica is there, and they're having this very subtle battle, I guess. You know, they're trying to get something from each other. Mm-hmm. But then they go to the window, and then there is the big flying pig.
Yeah.
You know, and me and Griff were looking at it.
I mean,
talk about background storytelling. This isn't background storytelling. This is a fucking pig, right? flying above, right? And yeah, and of course, I finally worked it out. You know, it's obviously Pink Floyd, right?
Yeah,
like they're animals.
Yeah,
which apparently like takes imagery or inspiration from Animal Farm, George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Yeah, but I think like honestly, just even taking it at its face value, right? You've got the pig floating high above London, and we've just seen the upper class, you know, living a completely different existence, a completely like gilded existence. Mm-hmm. And it's just that, like the pigs floating above everything else.
Do you remember that inflatable Boris Johnson?
Oh shit, I forgot.
That was good, right? Did you ever see that, Evan?
I don't think so.
I don't know why this happened, but there was a massive inflatable Boris Johnson baby.
I think it was back when there was a rejoin the EU movement, and they were like, yeah, make Boris Johnson into a big inflatable baby. That will solve the problem.
Yeah. And he was around for a while. They brought him to all the protests. He's fucking huge.
I think they made one of Trump too.
Yeah, I think so. All right, listeners, you got to just Google him. Just Google image this. It's really worth it.
The person here, his cousin, while he claims it's like this big ask, you know, I guess I should have mentioned the reason he's going there is that Julian needs to get these transfer papers for this prep, which we find out later is the pregnant woman, but he ends up getting it for two people where, you know, someone would have to accompany him. And we also learn at this time, I think it's right after this, when he goes back to see them to agree to the plan, is we learn that they had been together and they had a child and the child dies. And I think that what I like about not really learning this information until later, I think it really helps you like paint the picture of Theo's just his sad existence of just drinking, probably gambling. He just,
well, he
would lose all.
Yeah, hope and he, at like that he, point. He in a kind of literal sense lost his future.
Yeah, it's very.
They don't say how
they
he
do,
died.
It's
right?
A flu pandemic. And oh, then flu, me and Chris yeah, spent right, about right. 10 minutes trying to work out when swine flu happened to see.
Yeah, because we're like bird flu, swine flu.
It was 2000, around 2009.
No, swine flu was 2009, I remember, because I got it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think bird flu was before that.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, and again, that just speaks to like this overpopulated, like polluted, like interconnected world, you know, and like what's going to happen when a flu hits.
Yeah,
because a flu is going to hit like coronavirus did, and this is going to hit, and when it hits this type of world, what's going to happen?
Yeah, and it's also interesting in terms of like the different reaction each of those two have to it. Like Theo basically just like become like abandons everything, becomes this like sort of slob, this drone, whereas it seems like Julian as a character hardens herself and like it's almost like, well, I lost what was literally my future, so now I have to fight for another future. Whereas Theo is like, there's just nothing. And it's like a very interesting kind of dichotomy between the two of them, because when they bring that up, they immediately start fighting, right?
But again, it's talking about purpose, and I think this scene... Yeah, no, I think it's directly... I don't know if it's directly, but it's soon after the scene where he goes to see his uncle in Battersea Power Station, Tate Modern, whatever. Yeah. And he wakes up in the morning.
Yeah.
And, like, the scene is, you know, beautifully set, you know, quite on at work. Mm-hmm. And the sun is rising. And he wakes up as the sun is rising. It's small, and it's dim, and it's giving very little light, very little warmth, because this is like in November or something. It gives us the vibe it's about November, and it's cold light, but it's rising. And then on the right of the screen is the TV that's on, which has been on while he slept, by the way, because
it's his alarm, right? It's his alarm.
Just his alarm do it?
Yeah.
Turn it on?
Yeah, I think it's his alarm.
Forget that thing then. but on the TV is this ad for this drug, which will obviously come up, which is Quietus, which is the suicide kit that the government gives out. And in that scene, there's a man walking towards a sunset. So we have like left of camera sunrise, right of camera sunset, and here's Theo like making it's sort of like making his decision. You know, he's not sure. It's far. It's in the distance. It's not giving much light, but he stands up to it. Not like a hero. He's not like, you know. He's
more like, I guess I'll do it.
Kind of like that. Yeah. I think that scene happens afterwards, and this is the moment talking about hope, right? Yeah. Talking about Julian like was finding purpose through her political like activism, and he had given up.
Yeah,
and now here is just this subtle nod that he's like waking up. He's waking up, because Julian does say earlier on, you know, like, hey, you used to be on the protest line with me.
Yeah, she has that story about how he spiked police with ketamine and stuff.
Yeah. He used to be a bit of a hellraiser, right?
Yeah.
But he just was crippled by like this loss of his son, and he's just this onset of ennui, and that's just him. And as you said, Evan, just drinking, gambling, smoking.
Yeah.
Right? But now, I think that's the turning point in the movie.
Yeah,
for me, I think
it's where something switches in his head.
Yeah.
Well, and he also the thing I was just going to throw in there was too. He also mentions specifically that part of why he kind of left the sort of the fishes, or if it was that at the time, was the loss. He blames the loss of his child on this activism, which I think doesn't really make sense given that he had the flu. It's just he needs something to blame, get himself out of this. And he's slowly seeing maybe there is something to it again, that I can make a difference, even if it's may not actually lead to anything. but what have I got to lose? He has like this little inkling, it seems.
Yeah, he's a great hero. What's the term for it? You know, he's just a reluctant hero.
It is the classic sort of hero's journey, right? That like the events surrounding him make him into the best version of himself. Like that is just like that classic hero's journey he goes through. Mm-hmm.
And I think you mentioned before the scene in that really awesome shot later where they're trying to get to the farm this is when they've left the farm. I guess we could talk about the scene at the farm too, where they meet the fishes, and this is where he discovers, you know, that this woman is pregnant. Key is pregnant. Yeah.
But I think like that scene, like there's more going on in that scene. Of course, she's got the Birth of Venus pose, right? And it's just. It's not even subtle, right? It's just right there, right? But it works because that image is in our subconscious. It's in our minds, right? Yeah. This is the Birth of Venus, right? But she's surrounded. The first thing she says is they cut off their tits.
Yeah,
they have 8 tits, but they cut off their tits because the machine only fits 4 tits.
Yeah,
right. And like I did think, going back to this sort of idea of like what caused this infertility, and it's this sort of like bastardization of nature, mm-hmm. which can also come through with the pollution aspect of it. It's just like, does it fit the machine? Mm-hmm. Whatever fits the machine is best.
Yeah,
right.
Which again, you see with them, like they're basically like not even trying to solve the problem they have. Uh-huh. Right? You know what I mean? It's like, well, the machine's still functioning. Right?
Yeah, exactly. but the great thing about that scene is it's flanked with milking stations, I guess they're called, left and right, and there's these big glass like mm-hmm. like receptacles for the milk, and they're all empty.
Yeah.
Like their milk has run dry.
And this also then leads directly into the scene, because I don't think we mentioned, but Julian has now died.
Oh, yes. Yeah, like, I kind of mentioned. Yes. Yeah, Julian's dead.
Well, you talked about it.
But so there's the bit where they're sort of having the fishes are having like their sort of general meeting, and they're trying to work out what to do. And this is where you start to see, right, the two mainstream options which are open to this baby, which is it either becomes a political symbol, they literally say a flag, mm-hmm. or she goes to the state and they take the baby from her and give it to someone else. Mm-hmm. And again, you see like the way Theo sort of fits in the middle of this, where like basically everyone else is just looking at this baby as an opportunity to exploit. And Theo is sort of standing at the back, and he tries to make his peace. He says like, we should go public, and that's when they shoot him down. But then just after that, you see a baby cat run up to him and crawl up his leg. And so you see this thing of him being like positioned as like, this is the only guy who is not looking to kind of exploit this situation. This is why Julian said you should trust him, mm-hmm. right? Everyone else sees that this baby is now our opportunity.
Maybe the fact that all the animals, the dogs, when he comes to the farm, the cat, all seem to like him, because he's sort of maybe perceived in some sense as this sort of like fatherly figure, you know, because he's literally given, you know, care over Dee to her key to bring her to safety, to bring her child. And he does act very fatherly later when they're in the migrant camp. So maybe that's kind of, he feels like he needs to protect this child when he couldn't protect his own child.
Yeah, definitely. And this also, in this scene, completely separate from that, this is when they introduced the London 2012 sweater, which we've got to talk about. Like, we have to talk about it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, like, for any listeners, London 2012 was the London Olympics. And at that time, it had already been established it would be in London. I have this whole thing on this. I don't know if you want me to just let me go into it. It's going to take a few minutes.
Let's hear it.
So, I'm going to pour myself a drink for this one.
this is more related to the fact that like Cuarón is a Mexican director, and I promise you this is leading to a point, Evan, but it's going to take a while. So have you heard of the Tlatelolco massacre? So the Tlatelolco massacre is an enormous event in Mexican political history. It's an event that happened in 1968, and to this day every single person in Mexico has a very strong opinion on it. It's a huge part of like the Mexican psyche. And basically, this event was in 1968, a combination of left-wing students and trade unionists had a protest march in Mexico and went to a square called Tlatelolco, which is this massive square in Mexico City, at which point the army and
what doesn't it doesn't exist anymore, but the DTF, which were the Mexican secret police, blockaded the square and just indiscriminately fired into it. And this then led to what is called Mexico's Dirty War, where you had both like campesino, like peasant movements rising up to form like leftist guerrilla movements and urban guerrilla groups splitting off from the student movement, which went all through the 70s until the 80s and like saw massive state repression from the Mexican state. And the reason I bring this up is that protest that led to the Tlatelolco massacre, what they were protesting was that the Mexican government was clearing out working class neighborhoods in preparation for the Mexico City Olympics. And I feel like the fact that this Olympic sweater, which is in the rest, it's so prominent for the whole rest of the film. I feel like that Cuarón is kind of making a point here where these big events of like empty national pageantry, these events which like the Olympics is now like everyone knows it's infamous for clearing out like working class neighborhoods, that these events in and of themselves are sort of catalysts for right-wing movements, for government shifts into more authoritarian modes.
So if the movie takes place in 27. Uh-huh. So it's only about 15 years removed, and presumably this is already the point where people aren't having children or they're very close to that period. They felt it's still necessary to have the Olympics.
Yeah. I just think it's like, again, with the sweater, it was like when I was talking about the feet. It's like, well, why is this so prominent? It has to mean something. And that's, I do feel like Cuarón, as a Mexican director, he's making that direct link between the two events.
I would have loved it if that was the symbol that they had used the Olympics and somehow he like foretold that. But yeah, it's very, and the fact that it's white, you can't mistake the sweater the entire,
I mean, do you yourself have any thoughts on the London 2012 sweater? Were you in London at the time or?
I was in London in 2006 and 2007, so it was before that period, right around when this movie was out. But I mean, just in general, I remember when did London actually host the Olympics?
2012.
Literally, we're just talking about it. I remember specifically though that when they were building some of the stadiums in East London, they were tearing down some of these low income neighborhoods or just regular neighborhoods to build something that never ended up getting built, of course. And so I always think that Olympics are just a waste of money.
In the Olympic Village, they built what is still the world's largest McDonald's. And no one goes to it. It's still there, but no one goes to it.
Talk about a symbol of just like neoliberal capitalism and
folly.
It's just an empty giant McDonald's with. Well, I think that the scene in the remaining scene in the farmhouse kind of also symbolizes kind of where I feel like Theo kind of like takes the mantle over from Julian, where he kind of takes charge. He realizes that they're not safe there. They're looking to kill him. And so he gets them and he has this plan and he dismantles the truck, which they also seem to have fixed very quickly. I don't know
it just rolls down the hill. It gets to the bottom and then it doesn't stop.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. They realize that it doesn't work.
Them too is also just rolling down.
Yeah.
But he pulled like the brake cable as well on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they end up getting away. And I really, there's only a couple of scenes where they're kind of in the car, moving. And I think as soon as probably anyone who's watching this for the first time thought, okay, well, where are they going to go now? And so they, of course, to Jasper's house where they have the only ally left that they know. And you have a couple of interesting scenes there where he obviously now knows that she's pregnant and that he kind of I need to know because you're going to tell me, Chris, how it is that Jasper's death is foretold.
Okay, so this one's solid.
This one is solid,
right? This is just full circle, right? When we first meet Jasper, like in the opening scenes when we meet him, he picks up Theo from the train station and then they start driving down the road. There's a bit of exposition there. We're still building the world at that point because an truck full of immigrants go past and he goes, oh, they just escaped the most unimaginable horrors and now we round them up.
Yeah.
Like dogs or something. But he interrupts himself.
Cockroaches.
Yeah. And he interrupts himself by going, oh, pull my finger to Theo. And Theo doesn't pull it. So he pulls it himself. right? He does the action himself. And then, of course, now we are in Jasper's place, and the fishes do arrive, right? They rumble them.
Yeah.
They arrive, and
Jasper like plays distraction. He's going to distract the fish.
Yeah, exactly. Like Theo's like, come with us. And he's like, no, don't worry. I'll do it myself. And then we see this scene where they're like, where's Theo? Where are they? And he doesn't tell them. And instead he says, pull my finger. And he pulls it himself, and then he gets shot.
They shoot off his finger, right?
They shoot off his finger.
Yeah.
They shoot off his hubris, but he still doesn't give up. Yeah. So there, that's just full. That's perfect. and this is a double, but this is a double whammy. It's a double whammy because also in the previous scene, his wife.
Yeah, wife is, he gives his wife the quietest
kid. Yeah. And the first time we
see. And the dog.
Yeah. And the dog. The first time we see the wife is actually in the background, and in the foreground is a box of quietus.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
There we go.
He's consistently thinking, like, just in case.
Yeah. Kind of situation, well, I think he says, right, because when Theo first arrives, he's sitting there with that box open, and like he thinks he's dead, and then he just sort of like jumps awake. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what are you doing with that? And he's like, oh, it kills the rats, right? And he's like,
right, yes.
But yeah, it's interesting. I think like, because in that scene as well, that's where you get, like you were saying, that's where you get the actual story of like how Theo's baby died. And this is one of those moments, right, where you see him almost give up again in a way. Because like it's Jasper is talking to Key and the midwife, and Theo is in the foreground around the corner, like pouring himself a drink. And he overhears Jasper telling this story, and Jasper sort of tries to create this sort of cosmic narrative out of it, right? Where he's like, I can't remember what the words are he uses. It's like,
oh no, it's chance.
Yeah, chance and chaos or something like that.
Yeah.
And then almost immediately Jasper sort of sacrifices himself. And Theo's immediate line to the midwife is like, is that fucking chance or something?
Yeah, yeah, that's what he says. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, explain that one.
Yeah,
is that chance? And she said, it's part of a bigger thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like, he says, don't fucking touch me.
Yeah. And so again, you see him like, as a character, he's not in anything. It's like this, every single sort of current of people trying to deal with this problem, he's outside of it, right? He's not making this grand narrative. He's just accepting what's happened.
Yeah, like at the farmhouse, he's kind of with outside of sort of the circle of them. And he's also an outsider with his cousin as sort of this rich family. And he's sort of an outsider there. He really doesn't fit in anywhere, right? That's kind of his piece the whole time. And he avoids getting killed in the bomb in the opening scene because he's kind of like, he just leaves and he's kind of the outsider.
He almost feels like, it's been a long time since I've actually played any video game, but it feels like back in the past when you'd play a video game and they weren't like, you know, the graphics weren't good enough, so it would be like an unnamed character.
He's an NPC.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but he's not completely like that, but compared to all the massive characters around him,
yeah,
all the other characters around him are huge. Mm-hmm. And he's not.
Yeah,
you know, and there is just a sort of element to that. And of course, I guess, like, yeah, with those, that NPCs in video games, you can put yourself into those characters because they're not too obtrusive. Mm-hmm. And he's almost like that. He's almost this proxy for the audience, even though, not to say that the audience would be as valiant or as resourceful as Theo is, because that's ultimately, he is that.
He was the right guy.
Yeah, he was the right guy. Yeah.
It's like you needed that empty mold or, you know, character to create, to build, to kind of fit what they needed in this moment. Yeah, and so you alluded to Jasper dies, his wife and his dog have been quietly put to sleep, and they've now go to one of the very most, I think, one of the most haunting scenes in the movie, when they are, for some reason, they have to meet the fascist pig, as he has to call the cop later, in a school. And Key is outside swinging on the swing set. Framed, I found that scene just
window as well.
Yeah. And surrounded by dinosaurs,
that scene is,
like extinct dinosaurs. Yeah. And she's just in the middle, fragile. She's not fragile like as a woman, but she's fragile because she's swinging.
Yeah.
And there's like, she's just held up by like these thin ropes or chains. That's the fragility.
Yeah.
She's not fragile within herself, but the situation she finds herself in, that she's swinging in, is very, very, very fragile.
And you also, in that scene, you get the haunting monologue from the midwife where she's talking about,
like I was making appointments and I realized I had no appointments for 7 months, and then my sister had no appointments, and then like her cousin had no appointments in Australia. And there's that bit where she just like is sort of sitting with the darkness of that thought, and her line is like, I was there at the end, right? And then it's almost like Theo finally again sort of kicks into character. He's like, and now you'll be there at the beginning.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you do kind of see in it the foreshadowing where she doesn't believe him. She's sort of like, yeah, but you can see she doesn't believe it. Right? It's like,
I didn't see that. I didn't see that in. I can't remember. I thought she said, and she says, and now you'll be here at the beginning.
That's what Theo tells her.
Theo tells her, right? Yeah. It's almost like she knows that she's not the main character.
Yeah, she knows she's not going to make it.
Yeah.
Is there any foreshadowing of the midwife's death? So they kind of, it's very, you don't actually don't see her die, actually, right? Yeah. You just see her get.
No, I don't have it. I could make something up right now.
I'll tell you.
Well, go ahead. No. I was going to say is that Theo gets black bagged, you know, when he gets taken away to the fishes, and then she gets the black bag on top.
When Julian's dying in the car, she does that useless thing where she starts doing like a like chakras over her head.
Yeah.
And then the reason she gets dragged off the bus is because she's doing that.
I got it. I got it. This is the real one, right? It is this thing, and I did check this out obviously before the podcast. This isn't something I knew off the top of my head at all. But she says at that point, and at the very end, she's saying shanty, 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 right?
Yeah.
That's I think that's the thing she's saying. At least she does say that in the movie. Maybe she's saying it at these parts too. Not 100% sure. But shanti, shanti, shanti is the final line from the T.S. Eliot poem, The Wasteland. And that is like shanti, 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 she says at the end. And also the last part of that poem is just like London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. Mm-hmm. And then something in Latin.
Yeah.
And then it says shanti, shanti, shanti. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're echoing like just with her death, you know, where she says that at the beginning. She says that when we meet her. She says that when she leaves us.
I like that.
Yeah, and also Jasper says it.
Yeah.
Too often. He says it to himself, shanty, shanty, shanty. And the thing is about that poem was written, I think, after World War One, I think.
Well, T.S. Eliot, famously, he was an extremely patriotic British man until his kid got killed in World War One.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of broke him.
Oh, very cool.
And the main themes of that poem is about like the barrenness of the earth and how that is created by the policies of man and governance.
Yep.
So like that is, you know, obviously what's happening in this movie. This is obviously something Cuarón, like, he knew what he was doing with this, But
none of that is, those things aren't accidental.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you know Cuarón? That's Larry, actually from a poem.
There's not a single thing in this film. Like, I mean, you know, I remember when I studied film at university, like nothing's in the movie by accident. This is what that movie, like not a single thing happened by accident in this movie.
Yeah.
Right? It's like,
no, it's not like, you know, a cheesy action movie or some kind of thoughtless thing where they're in it to make, you know, one-liners and
but it's
and
also
nonsense.
But it's also
very
not
thoughtful.
Busy, you know what I mean? It's amazing in that way. It's luscious. It's actually luscious and it's rich. It's dark.
Yeah.
It's grim, but it's luscious, like with all of this imagery and the background storytelling as we've been talking about, and this central narrative which moves along at quite a quick pace. Not like us explaining it in this podcast.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess they won't quite be the same length, but I guess that kind of does take us to the final stretch of this movie, which I think is probably the only scene. I feel like I remember when I saw this, the trailer, when it came out, I recall specifically that they use a couple clips from the final part where they're kind of climbing through the rubble and there's all these very warlike shots. I'm curious to hear what you will think about the fighting between both the fishes and then, you know, the police and then also the people who live in this refugee camp. But they've gone into the refugee camp to get to a boat, to get out to sea, to find this other boat that's going to take them to the Human Project and restart life and give everyone a future.
It's explicitly their last chance, right? If they miss it this time, it's done.
Yes.
But I would start with that talking about the immigration cop, Jasper's partner, this like incredibly incredibly unsettling character, Sid. Like, and again, like with Sid, I was like, I remember I was watching an interview with Cuarón where he was talking about like the different influences that came into this movie. And he explicitly says Foucault. And I feel like Sid as a character
is literally the personification of Foucault's boomerang. Okay. They meet him. He's in this like sort of hardcore sort of military police gear. He speaks about himself in the third person, and it just like immediately makes you feel bad. And like, and there's two things, right? So that way he speaks in the third person, it's so bizarre. And it's like, it's almost like a representation of how these people who do this job dehumanize themselves, right? Like Sid is not the immigration cop. Sid is the guy who watches TV with his elderly mother.
Is that Sid speaking? Because that's what Sid would say.
Yeah, right.
Sid is not an immigration cop. Sid is.
Yeah.
As you said.
So he gets them into the camp.
He smokes strawberry weed that he gets from
strawberry
from
cough.
But so he gets them into strawberry the processing cough, center, and their journey in, we'll go back to that because there's so much in that too. But then he returns the next day. And when he returns, he is dressed as a pastiche of an Arab, right? Like he has this scarf on his head. He's wearing like a sort of like almost Afghan looking robe. But like, it's not real. Obviously, he's just like dressed as what he thinks an Arab is. And in that moment, he is that representation of Foucault's boomerang, right? It's like, where did all this violence come from? Where did it get learned? Where did it get developed? And it's like, it got developed in the Middle East. And then it came back home. And I feel like it's a very sort of simple way of representing that, but also like a very powerful way of showing it.
I mean, it's very also reminiscent of, again, like we've been saying numerous times, is how this represents very much modern, both, you know, the United Kingdom and also Europe, and just the disdain for people, especially from both the, you know, the anywhere in the global South, but, you know, Africa or the Middle East or any Arab country, is that they're seen with disdain, and him dressing up like that is just kind of like spitting in the face of them as well. In some sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of imagery like prescient to the time when the midwife, whose name have we said?
No, I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember her name, unfortunately. She gets taken off, right? She gets taken off the bus.
Miriam,
and
right?
And then Miriam, yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Miriam gets taken off the bus, and then, like, of course, this foreground, background, you know, in the background, there's just all sorts of hell breaking loose.
But you see two things, right? So as they're arriving, you see these sort of, there are like immigrants in cages and immigrants outside of cages. And in the cages, as they're arriving in the foreground, you see these people who, it's not on long enough to really see it, but you can basically see they're wearing the like sensory deprivation headphones, and like their eyes are covered, which, you know, Guantanamo Bay, it's extremely reminiscent. And then after Miriam gets pulled off and they pull out, there is a very clear shot of a cage with an immigrant standing on a stool with a bag over his head, which is like, it's literally the exact photo from Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's like the imagery is so clear in that section.
And if you also think about the year that this came out, 2006, I mean, the Iraq War is pretty fresh, you know, I guess 3 years, but, you know, filming it 2005, probably most people would see that and say, you know, as most people went along in general public of the Iraq War and everything about it. And so they don't see this as problematic.
I think actually that opening scene of the cafe being bombed was filmed like a month or two after
the bombings, in London.
Yeah. You know, so by the time this movie came out, you know, obviously that scene was obviously planned ahead of the bombings in London. Yeah. But by the time that came out, you're like, yeah, again, and this movie didn't make it good. It didn't make it do well in the box office.
Yeah.
You would think, well, maybe people didn't want to see this, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, because...
Yeah, it lost money from the budget. Yeah.
Did it? Oh, my God.
And I was going to say as well.
Yeah, it made $70 million, and it cost $76 million.
Oh, my God.
I was going to say as well, when we first said we were going to do this episode, I was looking up reviews from 2006 of the film, like 2006 children and men reviews. And I found the Guardian review from that year. And that movie it basically sees this. It is explicitly a film about the war on terror. It refers to London as being Beirutized. It refers to it calls the immigration center they go to as Guantanamo on sea. So like at that time, like that was how it was viewed, right? And in a way it was like, people like, it's like you, like we said at the start, it's like when we first watched it, it's like, well, that couldn't happen in Britain. Right. And now it's almost become more relevant because Quran had this fundamental understanding that like this is going to come back. This will come home. Right.
Yeah. And I think to even go on top of that imagery is once he, well, I will, I'll be, well, I'll, I'll get there in a minute. So you said they've entered in. They need to find this Russian woman who's going to give them shelter. You know, the woman with the dog, which you alluded to early on in the movie as carrying around. And that's specifically how they say to find her. It's this elderly woman holding the dog. And they put them up. And this is, you know, we obviously find that the baby is now born inside of this refugee camp, which I think also is somewhat symbolic in some sense in the way that, you know, we...
Very Christian again.
Yeah, very much. And then this the cop comes back to see them and, you know, obviously now has seen the baby. And this is where, you know, Theo goes into kind of major protection mode of... almost beyond himself of protecting the baby, you know, hitting him with a cinder block or something, and they escape narrowly. And then soon after this, we have all the racing around, and I feel like the destruction of this refugee camp, in my mind, felt very, you know, it was very grim and dusty. You could look at it as being kind of like a symbol of like the Iraq War or any of those cities in the Middle East that we've just leveled.
I think it's interesting because that is one of the scenes where you get the most, like I was saying, going in the Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay images. And then in the city when the rebellion starts, you see that funeral procession, which is chanting Allah Akbar. Mm-hmm. But there are also other scenes, like me and Chris were talking about when they're with the Russian family, like they've sort of found this secondary safety. There's a bit where Theo looks out the window and there's guys with AK-47s like running across the roofs. And both of us saw that. We're like, that is an IRA photo. Like, that's so IRA.
Yeah,
you know, just mean, it's
yeah. Like, yeah, like, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, I think grabbing a lot of imagery from Britain's like colonial past.
Yeah.
You know, into this one scene, like this melting pot. This is a melting pot of horror. Yeah. This is a melting pot of British made horror.
Yeah.
And it has all these elements from the Middle East, from Ireland as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and there's even when they arrive, a prominent Irish character who actually ends up sort of betraying them. Mm-hmm. And as well, like this is the scene where like Eastern Europeans are very prominent in this scene, right? It's Eastern Europeans who save them. But throughout this sort of like, you know, basically British Gaza, there are many Eastern Europeans. And I think that's something that maybe from an American context seems a little weird, but like the way British people, and not just British people, Western Europeans view Eastern Europeans is almost identical to the way that people in the USA view Latin Americans, right? Mm-hmm. And so you see like these kind of all of these parallels being smushed in together, right?
Yeah, the thing that I was going to say too, that's a really good point, but the throughout the movie, the only people you see who are not explicitly white British or other characters are in cages or living in this refugee camp. And this is the only place you see. And I guess Key is the only one who's has to be carefully extracted, not just because she's pregnant, but she would easily just be arrested even if she wasn't. You know, she's an enemy of the state.
That's a thing about Key. Obviously here in Bex Hill, in this little open air concentration camp, just like Gaza, except not little, she gives birth. And this scene, that scene, obviously, like, you know, it's a culmination of like the movie so far. We get to this point, the contractions have already begun, her water has already broken. But I noticed this, right? I think this is like, it's almost like the third awakening of Theo.
Yeah.
Because I mentioned one, it was subtle, right? Yeah. You mentioned one. But here's the thing that I was saying before. Everybody in this world is just trying to fucking cope.
Yeah.
Right, and they're looking for purpose or they're looking for distraction. So there's lots of scenes of like Theo's always smoking but never even finishing his cigarettes, by
he's
the way
got a, he's always got a little bottle of whiskey as well.
He's always got a little bottle of whiskey. Even his uncle and the son are taking pills. We don't know what they are. Yeah. There's quietus. I noticed on the bus there was another drug called Bliss. Yeah. And then in the background of the first scene, there was another one called Niagara.
They're just numbing themselves.
That's like a sleepy.
Everyone is just numbing themselves.
Sleepy Viagra, you know, it helps you get a hard on and then you fall asleep afterwards. I don't know what that's supposed to be. Yeah. But Theo and Key get into the room, onto the mattress, and then Mariska, right? Was her name?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, Marika or something. Yeah. She's there and she's they can't understand each other, yeah. Right? And he's just like, no. Before that, he's like, get out. She's about to give birth. Get out. Okay. And then she signals to him like, oh, give me a cigarette. And we notice actually there's a similar that happens on the bus on the way in as well. Yeah. There's some other people saying cigarette, and he doesn't give them. But this time she goes cigarette, and he just gives her the whole pack and just pushes her out.
Yeah.
And then goes, so he gives up his cigarettes.
Yeah.
And then he kneels down before Key, who's giving birth,
yeah.
And he takes out his whiskey
and
he sterilizes and he gets rid of his whiskey.
Yeah.
And he's all of it. He dumps it all over his hand. He sterilizes his hand. And then this is him. He's given up these falsities,
yeah,
like that are supposed to distract him, that are numbing him, because he is awakening. And these, and then now the baby is born.
Yeah.
And of course we have this very emotional scene.
And the immediate next scene, he fucking beats the shit out of his head.
Yeah, but that's what you were saying. That's what you were saying, Evan, about how like he goes into protection mode. But I think that like he's been moving towards this,
yeah.
But like that, the birthing scene, you know, like with him giving up all his vices, like he has to give them up,
yeah,
in order to give birth. No, he doesn't give birth in order to assist in the birth.
And yeah, like transition into the new world.
So in order, as I was saying, this is the third awakening of Theo.
Yeah.
And he has to abandon, in order to, for this awakening to happen, he has to abandon these things that have been distracting him from being a great man, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So he gives the cigarettes to Mariska.
Yeah.
And he washes his hands and he basically throws away his alcohol.
Uses all of it, yeah, uses specifically.
All of it in order to sterilize his hands, to clean his hands,
yep.
So he is able to assist in the birth of Key's baby.
Yeah. 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 This is the point where he, like, because again, like you said, we've seen him sort of progressively stepping up, right? Like, the first step up is like, well, I have to go with her. And then Julian gets killed and he has that moment. And then he kind of tries to sort of integrate himself into that debate with the fishes, doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
His second step up is getting the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
And then like his third step up is like, once the midwife gets taken away, he is now the only thing protecting Key.
Yeah.
And so that is the scene, right? That's, he transitions into like, now everything is about you.
Yeah. Like, and there's also a tiny other like background scene there. Obviously that's the main imagery and the symbolism of that scene, but also the dog. Mariska opens the door again,
yeah,
because the dog wants to stay in with Theo.
Oh, it's true. Yeah.
Right. So like the animals love Theo.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so then like, and also that is a great Mariska scene. So when like Sid has them at gunpoint, right. He like gut punches Mariska, and then Theo like sort of grabs, like bear hugs him and tries to like stop him shooting anyone. And then Mariska just comes out of nowhere with a fucking sledgehammer,
yeah,
and beats the fuck out of Sid.
Which, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, like, you're almost cheering at that point.
She's a great character. Then also like they're running out, and there's this big heavy metal door that's just ajar, and she can fit through.
Yeah.
Give her the baby.
Yeah.
And of course Key is reluctant, but Key eventually does.
And there's a 1 second panic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a 1 second panic where she's like, my baby. And she gets out.
Yeah.
Because obviously she is not trusting. But yeah. Mariska, like Jasper, well, Jasper's more, he means well.
Yeah.
But like the Orthodox Russians that they held up for a moment in their place, like they're good people.
Yeah.
They're good people in this world.
And one of the things in that scene, like the scene where they get into the house, because it's right, it's like Mariska banging on a door and they open like a little sort of like peephole. And then she points at the baby and the guy's like, oh. And it immediately cuts to it's Key on a bed with the baby and like some oranges. And then just like this, like sort of Russian grandma and Mariska just like in pure bliss. They're like so happy to see this baby.
It's a bit of respite. And I think maybe like the movie needed it because of the scene that's about to
it goes back to that thing, right? Where like, cause that is, you have that shot where it shows like all their old family photos, like this old life they had, like the Lenin in the middle. So they're clearly identified as political. And then like, again, their reaction, like every other person's reaction to the baby is, except for Jasper, right? Jasper again is sort of pure bliss, like you're a miracle. But everyone, like the fishes, they want to exploit it. And then like just these leftists see a baby and they're just so fucking happy, right? They're just like happy. That's all they feel.
Yeah.
And like...
They see it as a symbol of hope as opposed to a symbol of exploitation, like you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The scene where they end up inside of the building and there she's, you know, he's rescuing Dee. I feel like the most iconic shot in this entire, there's many of them, but the shot of them coming down the stairs, the baby in their hand through this just dust and rubble and the cops are just letting them go by and it's,
But again, before that, when they run out of the, I think it's like a bank or something that holds like this Orthodox family.
I think
like they run out and they got the sheep going left. Yeah. The sheep are white, and out comes Theo, and he's black, and he runs right.
Yeah,
you know, I was just like black sheep. That's too easy, but you know, there's definitely some color scaling going on there.
I mean,
but wait one second. The first thing we see, like, because the camera starts now following us, we're beginning the big shot here.
Yeah,
we see a woman holding her dead son.
Yeah, like crying,
weeping, just super. And what does that look like? La Pietà.
Yeah,
we couldn't save La Pietà. Why? Yeah. Because your methods are violent.
Uh-huh.
You know, the methods of violence are on show, and she's like holding her dead son, screaming, crying, and that's La Pietà, like Mary's, like the, well, at least they say, you know, like her face, her pensive face is considering the cruelty of man as she holds her dead son.
And I guess we should set that scene up a bit, right? Because basically they're about to get to the boat, and then the fish sort of intercept them, take Key away, and Theo and Marika sort of like are now in the middle of this enormous battle that's taking place. And then we have that, like, what it's almost, it's like a 3-minute single shot, right? Where Theo is trying to get back to Key.
Longer, I'd say.
He's hiding and behind, also, he dives across the, you know, behind the vehicle and
goes into the bus.
And interestingly, that shot almost killed the entire movie. Do you know that story?
I did see something about it. Did they have to reshoot it? The car? No.
They had to keep reshooting it. And basically the constant reshoots got them to the point that they were out of time. They're like, we got one more chance and that's it. And in that, the shot that's in the movie, the final take they used, when one of the blood bags explodes, it explodes on the camera lens. And so the camera lens has droplets of blood on it. And that was not supposed to happen. And so, but they were like, this is the only take we've got. We just got to keep going. And so that single shot, those blood bags, that is the only accident in the entire movie. and it makes that shot incredible. Like, it's such an incredible shot that you have like these drops of blood as you're like going through this battle.
And you know what's wild? Like, Griff told me that when we were watching it there a couple of days ago, and I had watched it, as I said previously, like a few weeks ago, and I didn't even notice it.
I didn't either.
Yeah. I didn't notice it. And then Griff points it out, and then I see it. It's just right there. There's 4 or 5 splotches of blood or little droplets of blood, like on the lens, blurring out.
Yeah.
You know? And they're there. And it doesn't distract.
Yeah,
but once you notice it, it adds.
It gives it like a grittiness, right?
The whole scene is very gritty. Like this, just the like I think I've been saying, sort of like the plumes of dust. Everything is dirty. Everything feels chaotic and falling apart. But the one thing that will, you know, lift them up is the spirit of, you know, the baby.
I think it's interesting as well, because I think Luke is sort of the villain of the story, right? Like, you know, the ultimate villain is the fascist state, but Luke is like the villain you can see. And I think it's very interesting that, like, in his final sort of moment before he gets killed, he suddenly becomes human. Like, seeing this baby has sort of jolted him back into reality almost, right? He says like, I forgot how small they were. It's like, it's so beautiful. And then his final line, which again, you know, we're talking about the relevance today. I don't know what the situation in Gaza will be in December when this comes out, but that final line he has where he's like, this is what happens when they try and take away your dignity. It's like, there's something that's like such a basic line, but it's so powerful as well. Again, it's like, it seems like, particularly like all of the fucking discourse going on with Gaza right now, like that basically his final line. He might have said something else afterwards, but like what is essentially his final line, where he's sitting holed up in this building and just says, this is what happens when they try and take away your dignity. It's a line that is, it's not like poetic, but it's like extremely powerful, right? It's like,
Yes. Yes. It's very haunting.
And of course, like, of course, and that's the thing about this movie. It's about the loss of hope.
Yeah.
You know, like when you have no hope.
Yeah.
And of course, obviously, like when I watched this first, like 3 weeks ago, like the situation in Gaza was not making the news. Mm-hmm. Right. And now, of course, with the recent situation that's going on, watching it again with Griff 2 days ago, it's like,
yeah,
oh my God. Right. This is now a completely different.
It's almost color. Impossible. When we were watching it, it's almost impossible not to see that refugee camp as Gaza. Like, it was almost impossible not to just view it as Gaza. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I watched it about 5 days ago. I think a couple of days before you, and I felt the same way where this is it. In some ways, it's easy to, you can see videos and see things that are happening in Gaza and you can kind of understand through those what's happening. But sometimes almost like through a film it's real, but it's fake. You know, this is a construction. It almost brings it to the point of just the horror, I feel like, is just magnified. At least in my mind, it feels that way.
Yeah. And I think because, like, again, so there's that iconic scene, right? So Luke gets killed and then the baby starts crying and everything stops, right? Like the world stops because now there's a baby. And, you know, like, and like the soldiers, the fascists, everyone stops. In that scene as well, like as sort of powerful and beautifully made is the ending of it also, like, so they get out of the building. They're still basically in the middle of the battle and the battle just restarts, right? They give them like 30 seconds to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it seems like one of those things that, like, even in this world where this baby is so fucking precious, the battle is still going to go on. We're still going to fight. We're still going to have, like, you know what I mean? It doesn't really solve anything. It almost goes back to Theo's original thing. It's too late.
Yeah, he says, like, yeah, it's too late. We already fucked it.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, that's the thing. It's like the thought of children or babies losing their lives is cause for pause.
Yeah.
It's not cause for stopping.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens. There is a pause. There is a moment. There is a moment of reflection. There's humanity in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's just fleeting. It's just a fleeting moment. Yeah. And that's the darkest part of it all.
Yeah.
It's just like how temporal. Mm-hmm. And not temporal, temporary.
Yeah.
Like this ceasefire is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think there's also another piece. So you mentioned how the battle continues right after that, and there's a gigantic explosion within this apartment building. And I think it very much parallels almost the very first scene of this entire movie where he's inside of the coffee shop and there's an explosion. It's like you're just saying is that there's an explosion at the beginning, explosion at the end, and things happening in the middle. I think the middle of the movie was like the pause that you're talking about. They pause to get this baby out. To get into this world and to out into a hopefulness, but to just chaos and explosions and death and everything in between.
Well, that's the thing. Talking about like beginnings and ends, I think that's like a theme that's in this movie a lot. And obviously now, like, we're moving on to like the final scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, without jumping the gun too much, but to stick with your point, Evan, is like what Cuarón said himself, that the end of the movie is the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, it's represented, right? Like, I was there at the end, you'll be there at the beginning, the sunrise. It's throughout the movie visually represented and like represented narratively.
Yeah. Because, yeah, that's what happens next. We get to, where do we go next?
So next, they Marika is still waiting for them.
Oh, yes. She reemerges.
With like the cave
paintings. With her dog still.
With her dog, yeah. Yeah.
And they see those cave paintings. And me and Chris did a quick little call last night where one of the things we were trying to work out is like, what do you think about the cave paintings? And we couldn't really come up with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a theory. I had a theory that, like, you know, this world is not going to survive. And, you know, for any future civilization or like new species or whatever's going to happen to this earth, you know, like what, like you look at the cave paintings to see what was important
to me,
to the people of the time. Yeah. And what the cave paintings in this cave, as you spotted, were helicopters, were war machines.
Yeah.
So people would find these caves underground and go, what was important to these people? Because we do see that the whole place gets bombed.
Yeah.
So there's nothing left on top.
Yeah.
But what's underneath is these cave paintings, and they symbolize and they show war machines. Uh-huh.
And to me, I think the thing that I thought of, which I think absolutely must have been on Cuarón's mind, is when the war in Iraq, the war on terror started, the common phrase was bomb them back to the Stone Age, right? That was the the common phrase used. Like, and so I don't know if it's literally just that simple, but
we'll leave that up to the listeners. The cave painting.
Yes, everyone.
We're grasping here.
I didn't think about that, but I like that interpretation. It's also just, I mean, if you're talking about that being the beginning, that or like this is the beginning, even though it's the end, is that's kind of like the beginning of humanity again, right? We're drawing in caves as, you know, the earliest depiction of literacy or any whatever we have. So I don't know.
Yeah, and as their boat gets pushed out, you know, like, you know, there's the framing of like the little porthole that they go through
going to the light.
It's not the most glorious light I've ever seen, to be honest. You know, it's misty, it's gray, it's very English.
Final scene again, you had foreshadowed the death of Theo in the beginning with him being the last one to die, and you see the buoy, you know, sinking around.
Just to go to Theo's death, the last thing he does before he dies is pretend to burp a baby.
Uh-huh.
It's the last thing he does, you know what I mean? And it's like, again, it's like this massively symbolic moment. It's almost like, I wouldn't say he's come to terms with, but it's like at the moment he dies, he's like imagining himself with his own child. I don't know. Yeah. Interesting, maybe.
Yeah, or I mean, we could go deep into it as he's talking about like rocking the baby and how to like make the baby feel comfortable as the boat is rocking him to death.
Yeah,
slowly as he gets paler and paler. But me and Griff have a massive disagreement about the end of this.
Oh,
movie.
Hates the ending.
You hate it. You hate it.
Evan, what do you think? Tell us about the ending there.
I think the ending, generally when I see movies, I don't like the, you know, the very just Hollywood, kind of very happy, just the normal ending you get in movies. I love movies that are, you don't know what's going to happen, or it's like a fade to black really quickly or something like that. So for me, I do like the ending because it leaves it ambiguous. You don't know the fate. You don't really know what's going to happen.
Chris thinks it's not ambiguous enough.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I want it more ambiguous. Yeah.
So you wanted not to see the boat come in?
No, not at all. I don't want that.
Just floating in the canoe.
Just floating, but, like she's alone. Like because the thing is, she hasn't been alone for this entire movie. And like, and she's only alone for this one moment. And like, or like, even if it was just extended more, where like the fear could set in. Because it's brought up earlier on. It's brought up on the bus on the way to Bexhill, where he gets angry at Miriam. Yeah. He's just like, wait, you haven't talked to the human project? You know, like, we don't even know if they're going to arrive. Yeah. And I just think that final scene could have been played longer, or it would have been a bit of an asshole move just to cut to black. You know, it would have been, I agree with that.
I also, like, I haven't mentioned this yet in the podcast, but I've said it to you like 5 or 6 times since we've been talking about it. Like, I think a big part of this is the ending is, that is what gives you Quaron's message that he's trying to give you. Because watching this film, you know, we talked about how like it just gets more and more relevant. This film feels like a fucking warning. Like, this was a warning to us, right? And I feel like that final moment, it is still ambiguous. Maybe it was too late to fix the world. Maybe it doesn't get better. But I feel like in that final moment, what Quaron is telling us is like, no matter how bad it gets, don't stop fighting this. Like, you just have to keep fighting it. Like,
I think the movie, if they didn't have the boat come in and they wanted to extend the scene, like you're saying, Chris, where maybe the canoe floats a little bit more and then maybe you don't have them both kind of in the same shot. You just see the boat coming in and you don't know if they're going to connect or something. If they didn't bring the boat in, I feel like the ending would be too dark, even though I do like the ambiguous. And I'm not saying I don't like a dark movie, but I feel like in this moment they needed like the glimmer of hope, because without it, this movie is just dismally depressing.
No, Griff said that. And like, you know, I'm not saying it should be like this. Jesus Christ, I don't know how to make a fucking movie, right?
We're quibbling over.
Yeah. But like, even if like it zoomed out and then, because it's very foggy, it's very misty, if you saw like something coming out of the mist, but like you don't know what it is, because you don't know, she doesn't know what her future is. So for this very clear, like shiny looking Norwegian fucking fishing vessel with a perfect paint job,
fresh
from Iceland, that says tomorrow on it, you know, I don't know. I just think that
I just think it could be moved a little bit, you know, a little bit darker, a little bit more.
I think, again, like, because I mean, like, you know, we talked about, like, alluding to, like, Cuarón has spoken about this movie very explicitly and what he wanted to do and what tell you. Mm-hmm. And again, like, I think what he wanted to tell you was, like, fight against it.
Yeah.
Like, don't give up on it.
You know what I mean? So, I agree with you. I just like being sad.
Yeah.
I always get in arguments, not arguments, but like disagree with my wife because she likes kind of more uplifting movies. And I'm like, oh, let's watch Children of Men. She's like, I don't know.
Yeah. No, like skipping onto another movie. I don't know if you've done this before, if you're going to do it in the future, but The Mist.
Oh my God.
The Mist with the director's cut ending, right? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. We won't spoil it here.
Even to harken back to the last episode, you know, sci-fi, right? Brazil, where that ending got changed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I remember listening to that. And you're talking about like the first time you watch it. I remember the first time I watched it, I was probably about like sort of 20. Like it took me a while to get around to it. And I remember watching it. I'd heard all this stuff about like they changed the ending. So that moment where he sort of like he has that like sort of escape moment, I was like, shit, did I watch the not correct ending? I remember thinking that.
I could totally see that if you didn't know, because you can watch that, you know, the bullshit Hollywood version of it. Oh, we've kind of gone through everything. I don't know if there's if you have any last Children of Men. Really, the only argument or disagreement of the movie is just how depressing they wanted to make the ending. But otherwise, in my impression, I've been another guest who's been on a few times said at the end, maybe we should say like, is this a movie you would tell people to watch? I think we've already proven the answer is yes, just repeat that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I like, again, it's like we said, for both of us, it's a movie. So you sort of find your way back to every couple of years, and rewatching it 2 days ago, just a flawless piece of art. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I wouldn't just say like, do I recommend this movie? I recommend this on an annual basis. You don't feel bad if you skip a year, you know? Don't feel bad if you forget about it, because you will rediscover it. And it's just so, as I said before, it's just so rich and luscious with storytelling, like technique, mm-hmm. in such a bleak and hopeless world with amazing characters, stunning acting, great set pieces. We talked about it a little bit, but not in depth. Like the set pieces in this are unrivaled to this day.
And unbelievable.
Yeah.
The battle scene is like, I mean, as intense as any other war movie you could think of.
Like, and I feel like it's more real, honestly. I feel it's more like, gritty.
It does. Was Harry Potter like this? I never saw it.
Well, he actually did make Harry Potter a little bit darker.
He was the dark one.
Yeah.
He made it.
That's
movie.
Actually like the one that's really good. The Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah. Oh, I have actually seen that one. Yeah. I was on at Christmas a while ago.
Yeah, it's always on. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was a good one.
But yeah, I mean, like, yeah, just yeah, like to wrap it up, just it's like an unparalleled in terms of almost science fiction. Because again, to talk about your Brazil episode. Your guest said it's like, you know, the best science fiction movies are the ones that are evergreen, that stay relevant. This is not a movie that stayed relevant. It's become more relevant. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
And I think a lot of dystopian movies don't have that. Like maybe, you know, they can feel relevant. I mean, I don't necessarily, Brazil has that same feel as far as, I mean, I'm sorry, that one does, but some movies don't. This movie is just, in 5 years, I mean, we could be at this, we're here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We're beyond it.
Yeah, that's no, and I think without ending on too much of a dark note, but like by the time this episode comes out, it might be more relevant than it is when we're recording it.
Yeah, that's a good way to end it, because we don't want no Hollywood endings on the
podcast. Yeah, right?
You have to end on a... But yeah, I think you're right, though. I mean,
sorry, I told you I like sad endings. I told you
that's totally. But yeah, no, it's been a pleasure to have you both on, and
absolute pleasure to be on as well. Thank you very much.
Very, very enjoyable.
And people should absolutely listen to your podcast, Bring Out the Dead, for
Bring Out Your Dead,
an entertaining jaunt of history that is. You know, especially an area that I didn't know that much about. So it's I always love learning new history.
Yeah,
so.
And as this podcast gets published in December, that will be when we're starting season two. So definitely go check us out. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. So I'll link everyone so they can check out season one. And then I guess if this one comes out, we'll link season two. I guess you can all find them all on Spotify. And
yeah. Yes. Yeah. All that stuff.
And I will tell you, We've just rearranged our second season because my girlfriend sent me a Mexican history book that unraveled an incredible story.
Yeah.
That like no one has ever heard of really. And so come listen to us for season two.
Yeah.
That you should definitely do that. And then you can listen to this podcast on all the same places, Spotify, Apple. You can follow both your show and mine on Instagram as well.
Oh yes, Instagram,
YouTube's.
Yeah. We're not very good at Instagram, but do follow us.
Yeah.
You should do that anyway. Yes, but you'll learn about the new episodes and subscribe. And thank you both for coming.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
It's
a pleasure.
Absolutely. And yeah, you've been listening to, of course, Children of Men, and you should go. If you haven't seen it in a while, go watch it, and then. Then watch it again next year.
Right?
Yeah.
And the year after that.
Right?
Yeah.
Just make it part of your annual routine.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
And we will catch you next time.